This is the BBC.
Hello from me, Shari Vahl.
And me, Simon Hoban.
Now, we make Radio 4's Daily Consumer Programme, and in this podcast, we want to tell you the most important and interesting things that we've learned this week.
We think we may have found one of the first couples to be married using a computer dating system.
And why the man who brought self-checkouts to the UK has, happily, had a change of heart about whether these things are actually a good thing.
First, though, the sugar tax. Now, it's quite complicated, Shari, isn't it? There's a lot of maths involved if you're working out the sugar tax.
It's much more complicated than I originally thought, and we've taken a little while to get our heads around it, even though it came in a couple of weeks ago. So what have you, people who actually buy sugar, made of this so far? Our reporter Matt Pinters has been looking into that.
Sugar tax, sugar tax. You and yours has been talking about it lots over the past couple of years. But do customers really care? It turns out they really do. Let's start with the manufacturers who didn't want to put the prices up at all. Back in January, AG Barr, who owned Iron Brew, preempted the tax by halving the sugar content of its fizzy orange drink. But as you know, Iron Brew customers are really loyal, and they weren't happy.
Can't believe Iron Brew are changing the recipe. Are you mad? I'm going to Costco and stocking up. Half the sugar? Nope, not for me. At Iron Brew, the new recipe brew is honking. Initial taste is okay, but weaker in flavour, then the aftertaste is bogging. Ruined by the English. Shame on you for messing with Scotland's treasure.
Famous pop hunk Harry Styles from One Direction fame didn't like the change either. He's really upset about Iron Brew, and here he is at his recent gig in Glasgow.
Please, if we could get some quiet just for 1 second. I'd like just maybe a 10-second round of applause for the old Iron Brew recipe.
Another company who's decided to change its recipe was Ribena. Our listener John Robinson has been drinking blackcurrant Ribena every single day for the past 40 years. And despite being the ripe old age of 81, he claims to still have all of his teeth.
Well, I regard it as a valuable source of vitamin C, a very pleasant drink. I use it to take my medication with in the morning sometimes. And I also use it to add as my breakfast course of fresh fruit. I have bilberries, strawberries and raspberries, and I add a few teaspoonfuls of Ribena just to give it a bit of juice. You can't get the old taste back. All you can do is disguise the sweetener. You can do that by adding sugar, which seems a bit stupid.
A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
But one company who decided not to change its recipe was Coca-Cola. Instead, they decided to make their bottles smaller. You now get a 1.5-litre bottle for the price of a 1.75-litre bottle. And that might be because last time they tried to change Coke's taste, they made a really big mistake.
Recently, an independent research firm ran a taste test between Coke and Pepsi. And the taste more people chose was the taste of Coca-Cola.
Back in the mid-80s, Coca-Cola decided to replace its tried-and-tested 99-year-old formula with a sweeter version. Its main rival Pepsi had seen sales boom, and in response, Coke was replaced with New Coke. But 3 months later, the company backtracked after receiving 40,000 letters of complaint. Coca-Cola also make a Diet Coke, which shouldn't be subjected to the sugar levy. It's made with sweeteners. But our listener, Nigel Taylor, thinks some of his local shops have been a little bit cheeky.
I went into my workplace cafe just to buy a Diet Cola. I was a bit amazed to find the price had gone up 20%. I was told by the lady behind the counter that I was not the only one who said this. It's obviously been caused some concern for other people as well. She pointed to a little poster on the wall saying that the sugar tax was now in force. And she said to me that she felt that probably what was happening was that the pricing structure on the computer system they have probably doesn't discriminate between sugar drinks and non-sugar drinks. And that was probably not an unreasonable assumption. But I was just a bit concerned in case what might have been happening was a sort of like stealth tax, people just taking advantage of the 20% rise just to put the price up of drinks that really should not be taxed at all.
That was Nigel Taylor. The supermarkets have been responding to the tax as well. And our listener, Lillian Gill, noticed something fishy when going to buy her favourite high-juice squash.
Dear you and yours, I prefer squash with sugar to the aftertaste from artificial sweeteners and buy the high-juice 50% for the toddler group I run. Sainsbury's have increased the price to £2.28 per litre. It used to be £1.20. I didn't think that sugar tax was £1 per litre. Will the other supermarkets hike the price by a pound too?
We did ask Sainsbury's about this, and you're going to have to keep with me here. They say that the levy added to the drink has to be multiplied by 5 because it's concentrated. The dilution ratio of this product is 1 part cordial to 4 parts water. So the 1 litre bottle makes 5 litres of drink. When diluted, this product contains between 5 and 8 grams of sugar, so the levy rate is 18 pence. Multiply all that together and you get the £2.28. Still with me? Good. Waitrose offer the same drink, but they only charge £1.50 for it. Asda has changed prices too. A multi-pack of Cokes from Asda, for example, has increased by almost £3 from £7 to £10. It's a whole £1.10 more than was expected under the tax. The sugar tax obviously has been interpreted in many different ways, and we'd really like to hear from you if you spotted any sugary scandals.
Matt Pinter's reporting on how the sugar tax is going down. You may have noticed changes to bottle sizes in the shops. There's been a Twitter storm, you know about that. Isn't there a Twitter storm?
Indeed.
Now, on Tuesday's Call You and Yours, Shari, you were presenting that programme, and we were asking the question, what are the rules of modern dating?
We were. It was really interesting, yeah, because online dating's now the way most people meet their partners in the UK. And you remember all the taboos that started? I can remember having friends who'd met on the internet, and there were sort of, you know, downward glances and slight sort of sideways looks at each other. Nobody's worried about that anymore. Everybody does this. But there is etiquette, isn't there? And etiquette is different from when you meet people face to face, it would appear. So the etiquette specialist, Debretz, have published this week a guide to help people who are over 50 navigate their way through dating in 2018.
That's right. The main concern seems to be feeling out of touch with modern dating rules, maybe a lack of confidence to make contact with the person you're interested in. And then if you do finally meet, what are the modern rules? Who pays the bill these days? Many struggle with writing a positive profile about themselves even. You know, talking yourself up is something perhaps we're not used to.
Terrifying, I would have thought. Yeah. And also, I was really interested. What happens when you've been emailing and you've been texting and talking to each other on the phone maybe, and you have photographs, but then you finally turn up and he's wearing a patterned tank top, which you don't like, and you think, oh no, oh no. What's the polite way of saying thanks but no thanks?
I just wonder why people do that. I mean, why would you put a photo of you that's 10 years old on there? Because you just must know that as soon as you meet them, they're going to be disappointed.
Well, that's what one of the callers said. And he said he didn't want to be rude and he was slightly embarrassed about it, but that the woman who turned up to the date could have been her mother. And, and I think he was a little... he was sort of disheartened by the whole business.
One of the things that surprised us was that people actually look up other dates whilst they're on a date. And that's not regarded as unusual.
One woman rang us. We called her Charlotte. She'd met and detailed wonderful afternoon tea. They'd been
champagne.
Out with flowers, the full hit. So he clearly made her feel very special. She then discovered that he was seeing other people, but then she revealed that she didn't have his telephone number. Now, the numbers of people saying, wanting to alert Charlotte to be really careful of this, she clearly lost her heart to him. It was quite clear when she was speaking that she felt deeply for this man.
Yes, yeah. She referred to him as fantastic, didn't she? And yet didn't have his phone number. You mentioned Charlotte, but one that we didn't have time for was Cynthia. And she got in touch via email to tell us how she met her husband using one of the first ever dating services. Now, that one was called Dateline, and she saw the advert for it 50 years ago.
I filled in a form and he filled in a form. And they went up to Dateline computers, and then the idea was that they matched you with potential partners, and you were sent through the post a list of, I think it was about 5 names, with phone numbers, people that you could contact. So I contacted my now husband. He was my second contact. The first one I did meet, but I didn't really care for him much. And then on our first date, we just clicked. And it was virtually love at first sight. My father was horrified that I was doing this. And he said, you just don't know who you're going to meet. It might be some murderer or anybody. That was a slight warning, shall we say. But anyway, I was pretty confident that I could take care of myself anyway.
Why did you use, in 1967, such an unusual way of meeting people?
I was a young teacher, and where I lived in a village, I didn't get to meet any people of my own age, and I just thought this was a good way to meet maybe the right person.
And did you tell any of your friends? Because, you know, for many years there was quite a lot of secrecy about people meeting online.
No, I didn't. I didn't tell anybody other than just my family when I was about to go and meet my future husband.
Now, do you believe that, I mean, this was 1966, 67, and Dateline computers was only created in 1966. So do you think there was actually much computer matching going on at all?
I think it was pretty random. I think we were just extremely lucky.
That was Cynthia, who met her husband on Dateline computer. I can remember advertisements for it in the papers and on trains very clearly. And it was the only one.
Right.
So it was there was nothing else like it. Whether or not they actually used computers to match people, you know, in the way the algorithms do now, or whether it was just two people on... in computers in those days had these punch cards with holes in them. I assume they just stored their records on those punch cards.
Right. Very rudimentary.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Now, Shari, Jarvis Cocker had an unusual idea about where to take his date in the song Common People. Do you remember it?
Oh,
the lyrics. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere, sang Jarvis. I mentioned that only as a clumsy segue to our next item, Shari, which is about self-checkouts at supermarkets. It's something we've been talking about on You and Yours for a couple of weeks because Sainsbury's have installed CCTV to stop people stealing at them. I don't know if you saw that story.
No, I didn't. But, you know, I have never got through an automatic checkout without it going wrong. Unless I've got a teenager with me. They don't work as quickly as I do. They don't work fast enough. When you push a button on the screen, it doesn't react quickly enough to me.
No, it's true.
It keeps me hanging around. They are gift from Satan. I hate them.
Well, they came to the UK in strong feelings from Shari there. They came to the UK in 2002. Rhys Eiley was the man who brought them here for Marks and Spencers. However, he's had a bit of a change of heart about them, as he told Peter White.
Back in the day, I do think they were a great addition because with Marks and Spencer, there was two things we were trying to do. One was to improve the conditions for our staff at the checkout because the tills themselves hadn't been designed or redesigned for many, many years and ergonomically they weren't really fit for purpose. And for customers, there was a real need for customers who were just buying their sandwich and so on at lunchtime to be able to go in and do it quickly, and it seemed like a great solution.
But recent reports have suggested that people are actually less honest with self-service checkouts than they are with human cashiers. That isn't what you saw at the start, though, is it?
No, it wasn't. And I think that is a little bit of a shame. And I still think that most people who come into the supermarkets are honest and do want to pay for their goods. But I think that over time, some of the retailers that are using them haven't really been focused on putting the customer first. In some retailers, it has been about cost-cutting. Let's get away from employing staff and putting these self-checkouts in, which is a real shame. And I think they serve best when they're part of a suite of checkout options so that customers do have a choice.
Research into self-service checkouts by Radio 4's Jenny Murray, amongst others, has found they're actually slower than human cashiers. I mean, is that because people are taking too much through them?
They were always really designed for customers with small purchases, but frankly, a customer should be able to use them whichever way they want to, even for a large trolley. But it's one of those things, it's a little bit like sitting in a traffic jam in the car. We always feel better if we're moving, and we might go up some little side streets, and it might actually take us longer than sitting in the queue. And certainly that was our experience, that customers preferred, they actually quite enjoyed using the self self-scanning checkouts, even though not in every case did it actually improve the speed of the operation. And you see lots of people, you know, they use it for their children as well, and their children have a go at doing it. It makes the shopping experience for some a little bit more interesting.
But do you think self-service checkouts have got a real future, particularly in a world where, you know, Amazon, for example, is now letting people walk out of shops without scanning over in Seattle because basically they've got them bugged. They know what they've bought.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And I think that's a very what Amazon are doing there is actually very interesting. And I think we will see things change, like the way people pay. So that sort of the grubby bit of handing cash or something over will change as people do through apps and mobile and so on. But I still think for those retailers who've got a physical presence on our high street, there is a need for really great customer service. And that's where I think some are going wrong. You know, that's the last point that many customers see with the brand. And having a great experience there, whether it be a self-scanning checkout or, more importantly, for the checkout operators to give that smile, to be able to pack the bags and everything, I think there's still a place for that in retail.
Rhys Eilie there. Thank goodness he's had a change of heart. I can supply him with plenty teenagers if he needs them.
We're going to stay with shopping for a moment because you might have seen adverts on the TV for cashback sites. Now, they promise discounts paid in cash for shopping through them for all kinds of things.
Now, one of the biggest is Quidco, and it was set up in 2005. And the company claims that a penny in every pound spent in the UK is now spent through its site. Andy Oldham is the Chief Operating Officer at Quidco, and Winifred asked him how the site makes any money.
So we have two versions of the site. One is a completely free basic version and one is a premium version. For the premium version, we charge £5 a year. Now, we only take that £5 a year if you actually use the site. So it's a retention fee rather than an upfront fee. And on the basic version of the site, it's completely free, but we show display adverts, so adverts from the likes of Google. So we make money from advertising in that form as well. We also make money where we have some of our retail partners wanting to cut through the noise of the rest of the retailers and display their offer. So we'll take an offer from, say, Sky, take money from Sky to show that offer on the homepage or in the emails to our members.
If you look at complaints online about you, they tend to be about people not getting the cashback they believed they were promised or having to wait ages and ages before they get it. Why does that happen?
It's a very valid point. If you buy goods through our site, and just to be clear, the process is you join Quidco, you click through from our website through to the retailer's website, and we track that through cookies. So long as you make a purchase on that site, it's a valid purchase, meets the terms and conditions of that offer, and that you don't return your goods or cancel your policy or your subscription, then you'll receive the cashback that was promised. Sometimes the cashback is declined because the terms and conditions of the deal weren't met. Sometimes the cashback's allocated to a different advertising channel. So if you were to click off from our website but then maybe visit another advertising site, then the sale would be attributed to a different website. So we wouldn't receive the advertising commission from that retailer, so we wouldn't be able to give the consumer their cashback.
Does it just sometimes go wrong, though? You know, that sometimes the retailer just keeps everyone waiting for ages and ages for reasons you can't explain, and sometimes they don't give quite the discount that they said they were going to give.
That does happen. And we have a team, small army actually, in Sheffield who are there diligently chasing down cashback and incorrect amounts and declined cashback transactions for our members. You know, we have a what's called a claims process. It probably accounts for 5 to 10% of transactions. We try and do our best to try and chase those monies down and get the money for our members.
How many are in the small army then?
As a business, we are around 170, 180 staff.
That's a very small army.
Well, we like to ensure our costs are low because, you know, we're trying to run a business.
I suppose my point is that really enough? You say you've got 4,500 retailers on the site. I think you said they're chasing down complaints about, what was it, between 5 and 10% of all the transactions? I mean, that's a big proportion of transactions where people don't get what they think they were going to get, and a very small number of people handling those complaints, isn't it?
No, I wouldn't say it was a small number of people in proportion to the amount of transactions that were flowing. I've been doing this for 13 years, and you know, I think we're the pioneers in the cashback industry in the UK, and we've set new standards and processes across the industry to try and make that process as efficient as possible. But ultimately, we're at the hands of the retailers and how quickly they can respond to the queries that we're trying to raise in order to resolve those.
Another drawback is that sometimes retailers offer bigger discounts if you go directly to their website than you can get by going through your website. So, for example, ASOS, you're offering 10% cashback for new customers. If you go straight to ASOS, they're offering 12%.
Absolutely. And if you're prepared to go through the effort sometimes of negotiating directly with a retailer, the chances are you may end up with a higher discount or a lower value product. The reason that we have the rates on our sites is down to the marketeers of those businesses who are looking to secure a certain volume of sales from our particular site and our channel. So if they are decided that in their marketing mix they want to try and drive new customer signups, then advertisement on their site for 12% for everybody who visits that site is going to have a bigger audience than just the Quidco audience.
Before you can do anything on your site, you have to type in your email address before you can even browse, before you have signed up. So you are gathering data, aren't you, from that very first click. Do you make any money out of the data?
No, we don't actually. You can use the sites. You can search on the site without signing up.
Not easily, because I have been on and given it a try. I didn't find that search without giving your email address. It looked to me, and I went on it more than once, as if the only way I could browse was by putting in my email address.
That's fair. It could be a lot easier. I would much prefer us to change that homepage in due course. We will, to show all the offers that are available. We do need to capture your email address before you click out from the site.
Why?
In order to ensure you get your cash back.
Yeah, but if I'm only having a look, why do you need it? You don't need it.
No, before you click out from the site. So you can
Before I buy anything.
Correct.
Okay, so you're going to change that?
We're going to make it a lot clearer, hopefully, yeah. But no, to your point about data, we don't make any money from your personal data on the site.
Because I clicked into your privacy policy. I mean, that's my job, obviously. And it does give you very wide permissions to share data with third-party companies. So wide, in fact, that I think what it says up there is probably in breach of the new data protection laws.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point. You know, we're looking to overhaul completely our privacy policy and Canada Holds Agreement in light of the GDPR ahead of 25th of May to exactly that point. And I think for Quidco, this represents a real opportunity. If you sign up for Quidco with a Quidco-specific email address, you shouldn't get marketed to, or you won't get marketed to outside of Quidco. We're not in the business of selling email addresses and personal data. So actually, the rules and regulations that come in around data privacy, I think, play to Quidco's favour.
I should say that I put in my BBC email address and not my private one because I thought, oh, here goes. I'm now going to be inundated with advertising. But in fact, nothing has come. No one has advertised to me.
That's good
since,
to
hear. I tried your website. Is your company growing?
Yes, absolutely. We have businesses in the UK. We operate a different brand in Europe under Shoop in Germany and France. We launched there 2 years ago and the UK continues to grow at around 5 to 10%.
Andy Oldham, Chief Operating Officer at Quidco. And that's it for this week. If you want to listen to any of the items we've been talking about, all the programmes are available to listen to again via our website.
And we also want to hear stories from you. Please contact the programme. The email address is youandyours@bbc.co.uk.
And please do leave us a review. We welcome all feedback, good and constructive.
We're back on Radio 4, Monday to Friday, from 12:15.
This is the BBC.